I next met with Dr. Sarah Goldberg, and she began her conversation by commenting on the rapidly emerging role of checkpoint inhibitors in lung cancer.
The PD-1 inhibitors and PD-L1 inhibitors, again, are now being developed in multiple cancer types. The initial approvals were, again, in melanoma with nivolumab and pembrolizumab. But now we're starting to really see data that's incredibly promising in phase 1 trials, and now we've gotten to phase 3 trials that we've seen some incredible data for some of the agents. And then, of course, nivolumab was recently approved for patients with lung cancer of the squamous cell type.
Can you talk a little bit about the clinical research data that was behind that approval in squamous cell?
So nivolumab, again, a PD-1 inhibitor, was compared to docetaxel in the second-line setting for patients with squamous cell lung cancer. There's also a very similar trial, nearly identical, but it included patients with non-squamous cell lung cancer. The data for the squamous cell patients came out earlier this year in 2015, and there was a survival benefit for patients receiving nivolumab versus docetaxel, again, in the second-line setting after failure of a platinum-based doublet. And that led to the approval of nivolumab for patients with squamous cell. And then more recently at ASCO of this year, we heard about that same trial I mentioned in non-squamous patients. It's a very similar design, nivolumab versus docetaxel in the second-line setting, but again, in non-squamous patients. And that data also looks very promising with a survival benefit. It has not been approved in non-squamous patients at this point.
What kind of response rate has been observed in both of those settings, and what are the durations of responses that are seen?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, with many trials, we talk about response rates as being such an important endpoint, and of course it is, but it's really what the second part of your question that I think is even more exciting with these drugs is the duration of response. So the response rates do look better for nivolumab than with docetaxel, but they're still lower than I think many people, of course, would like to see, more like in the 20% range. But again, it's the duration of response that really is the benefit here, and then also the survival that you can see with some of these patients. Many patients living several years when they have a response, and these patients are heavily pretreated, you know, have been through several lines of chemotherapy, and they're able to benefit from the PD-1 drug, from nivolumab, and live for many years.
Let's talk about some of the patients that you've treated with these agents, beginning with your 62-year-old man.
Mm-hmm. So this was a patient that I met when he was first diagnosed. He's 62 years old. He has squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. I'd given him chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. And he really, after receiving several cycles, he really was having significant symptomatic and radiographic progression. He had fatigue, anorexia, weight loss, really getting quite sick quickly. We discussed second-line chemotherapy, and this was right around the time when nivolumab was just becoming approved for really this patient population. So we talked about chemotherapy, and he really did not want the toxicity of chemotherapy, and I did not think that that was unreasonable in him. And then again, this data was coming out, and the approval had just happened with nivolumab. So we also talked about clinical trials at the time. It's something I always talk about with my patients, even when there is a standard drug available. I always talk about trials because, and as we talked about with the response rate, and obviously not every patient is responding. So I always talk about trials. Maybe we have something better. But he really wasn't a trial candidate because he was declining quickly and performance status was an issue. So we decided to go ahead with treating him with nivolumab. And he really, within a few weeks, had a dramatic improvement in really every symptom. He was having some pain from bone metastases. He, again, was having the fatigue and anorexia, and that all improved within just a few weeks, which really was remarkable. He had been unable to work anymore, and now he was starting to go back to work. And it really was an incredible improvement, really just in a few weeks. And he's done so well with the drug. He's had no symptoms. And it's been over 6 months now that he's done well with treatment, and scans showed really nice response as well.
What's been seen in general in terms of time to response? You know, I think we have this sort of traditional idea that immunotherapy takes a while to work, and yet it seems like, particularly with these PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies, you can see quick responses, as occurred with this man.
That's right. So most patients, if they're going to respond within the first few months, 2 to 3 months. And that's what happened with this patient, that clinically I could tell he was responding before I even got scans. It was just a few weeks. And I've seen many patients like that. But there are some patients who have these delayed responses. And I think what is often confusing in the clinic is this idea of pseudoprogression. And also that goes into the delayed response idea. So patients who, and their initial scan actually shows some, looks like progression, either new lesions or growth of existing lesions. And clinically, they may be doing very well. And those are the patients that I try to keep on therapy for, you know, another 6 to 8 weeks, get another set of scans and see what's happening, because we do sometimes see delayed responses or some growth or new lesions and then regression. I think that's something that we talk about a lot, and it can happen. We've seen it happen. It's not as common as just the traditional responses where you see improvement initially, but it does happen. So for some patients, when they otherwise are doing well and the progression does not seem to be significant and they're clinically doing well, I will try to keep them on because we can see this pseudoprogression with these patients.
Now, did this man have a PD-L1 assay done? And what's been seen in general in terms of correlation between these assays and treatment benefit?
So he did not have a PD-L1 assay done, mainly because there is no standard PD-L1 assay. So all of the assays that are done that we talk about in the context of these trials are all done as part of the trials. So for a patient who you're considering using nivolumab, unless you get it done in a research lab, there's really no way to check for PD-L1, and it would be very difficult to know what to do with the results. Many of the trials, or really all of the trials, have looked at PD-L1 as a predictive biomarker for benefit of PD-1 and PD-L1 drugs. And I would say it looks like PD-L1 is a decent biomarker. It does look like if the tumor has PD-L1 expression, that the response rate and the benefit increases. But it's not so straightforward. It's not like in other patients with lung cancer who have an EGFR mutation and you expect them to benefit. It's very different than that. It's maybe the likelihood increases of benefit, but it's not all or nothing. So patients who do have the biomarker, the response rate is still, again, it's different for different trials, but it's still not high. It's still in the 50 to 60% range, depending on the trial, also depending on the cutoff and the assay you're using. And patients who don't have PD-L1 expression, they still can benefit. So the trials that have looked at PD-L1 negative patients, the response rate there is still reasonable. It's somewhere in the teens or so. So, and that's actually a reasonable response rate when you're looking at it compared to a chemotherapy like docetaxel, which also has a low response rate. So for this patient, I really couldn't have checked his PD-L1 status because he wasn't on a trial, but I also didn't feel like it was necessary, even if I could have, because he really had not great other options. And even if it was negative, there still is a possibility of response there, and I would have tried it in him anyway.
Now, is this man a smoker? And what's been seen in terms of correlation between smoking and treatment benefit?
He was a smoker. He had quit years ago, but he was a smoker in the past. And it interestingly does look like patients who have a history of, or smokers, do have an increased chance of benefit from the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors compared to never smokers or light smokers. But again, that it's not all or nothing there. We've seen many patients who have never smoked or have a light smoking history and they've had benefit, but it seems like it's a lower chance of benefit.
I've heard people talk about mutational load in that regard, maybe related to smoking. How do you sort of think through that concept and what do you think about it?
Yes. So there have been studies now looking at other ways of predicting who will be benefiting from the PD-1 and PD-L1 drugs. And the PD-L1 expression and using that as a biomarker has probably been the most explored, but there are other things that now we've been looking at, others have been looking at. And one is this concept of mutational load or burden. So what's been seen is that patients whose tumors have a high burden of mutations, that they have a higher chance of benefit in one particular study, pembrolizumab, another PD-1 drug. And it's not entirely clear why that is. I think one possibility is that the tumors that have high mutations are more recognizable by the immune system because they're very abnormal. And so then when you activate the immune system, they're more easily recognizable to the immune system because of the abnormal number of antigens on the surface of the cells. But again, it's not an all or nothing, so patients with lower mutational load can still have benefit, as they saw in the study, but it does seem like there's a higher chance of response. So that is another really interesting avenue of research. But again, it's something that will be very difficult to use in the clinic at this point and needs a lot more work to really prove that that's something that may be used clinically.
What about correlations with histology? This man had a squamous cell. Initially, it kind of looked like maybe the patients with squamous cell did better. Now, at this point, How does it look?
Right. So initially, there were some studies that looked like there was higher response rates with squamous cell patients versus non-squamous. I would say it's very difficult to distinguish at this point, and patients with adenocarcinoma can do incredibly well. So I don't see it as a difference. When I'm thinking about a patient, I wouldn't have a hesitation because they don't have squamous cell in any way.
What about tolerability? You mentioned that this man's kind of cruising through therapy. What kinds of problems have been observed?
Right. So it's one of the incredible things about these drugs is many patients could have no toxicity or really very limited toxicity. The thing that can be challenging, though, is when patients do have toxicity, they're sometimes somewhat rare things that we don't typically see. So we see a lot of endocrinopathies, or I shouldn't say a lot, but we do see endocrinopathies, thyroid dysfunction. We see adrenal insufficiency in patients. I recently saw a patient who really had nonspecific symptoms, was fatigued and not eating well, but really a big difference from just a few weeks before, and her cortisol level was undetectable. So we really can see some incredible things with the endocrine system, and you just need to keep these things in mind, and it's so different than with chemotherapy because it's not something we necessarily jump to thinking of checking a cortisol level in some patients. And then the issues that have been problematic in some patients on these trials that always need to be thought of in patients being treated with these drugs are pneumonitis and colitis. I think those are probably two of the bigger things that need to be kept on the radar when you're treating patients. So pneumonitis was seen in the initial trials with nivolumab, and there were several deaths. I think since then, now that people are aware that this is a potential issue and can be a life-threatening issue, we've become really aggressive in working patients up for pneumonitis, if that's even a remote possibility, and then being aggressive with treating it with steroids. Colitis is less common than it is, let's say, with CTLA-4 drugs, but it's still possible. And especially when we start combining the immune therapies, it does seem like colitis can be an issue. So again, a patient with some mild symptoms shouldn't be taken lightly because these things can become very serious with, as we know, the immune system is a powerful thing. So it can really become an issue with pneumonitis and colitis and others, hepatitis. You know, really any organ can be affected by the immune system and by these drugs. You can have skin toxicities. For the most part, steroids are the way that we treat them. For more mild symptoms, using oral steroids can be fine. Some patients require IV steroids to really get a hold of their symptoms. But overall, they're very manageable as long as you make the diagnosis quickly and can treat aggressively with steroids, and often a long taper is required.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes is from Julie Bramer, who says she tells her patients anything that ends in an itis can be seen with these.
It's very true. And I think we've seen it all. It is amazing.
What about the patient with prior autoimmune diseases? I don't know how often you see that, people with Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. When you do encounter a patient like that, how do you think through the possibility of using these drugs? And what do we know about what happens when you use these drugs in those patients?
Right. So this is the challenge when a drug is first approved in a patient population. So the trials, for the most part, exclude patients who have previous autoimmune diseases at baseline before they go on trial. So some trials allow more mild autoimmune issues like hypothyroidism or psoriasis. But I think I could pretty much say that all of the trials exclude more significant autoimmune diseases like Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. Anything that's required immunosuppression in the past, I think for the most part, has been excluded on trials. So it makes it challenging to know what to do now that we have the drug available for use, not on a trial, because technically you could use it in a patient if you wanted to with a prior history of autoimmune disease. I think there's a lot of concern, and that the reason it's been excluded from trials is that if you treat someone with one of these agents who has an autoimmune disease or had one that's now under control, that you could reactivate it, and that could be a serious issue. Yes, it's always, with anything in cancer, and particularly lung cancer, such a challenging disease to treat, and a lot of times it's always something that you have to weigh the risks and benefits. If someone had a very severe history of autoimmune disease, I would be very, very hesitant to give them one of these drugs because of the significant possibility that they could have a recurrence of that toxicity or that disease. If it was more mild, I might treat cautiously and be very careful if they are starting to develop symptoms. But it's difficult to know what to do because the trials haven't included it. I think as we treat more patients not on trials, we'll get a better understanding of how prior autoimmune disease predicts for future issues on these drugs.
What would you do if this man were, unfortunately, to develop progression? What would you be thinking next? Would you sort of abandon the idea of immunotherapy or any other alternatives?
So we see patients who have, of course, like with any other cancer treatment, different types of progression. So in someone who's progressing really at one or maybe two sites, we've been trying to really think about whether if overall they're benefiting from the drug, whether we can treat that site locally and continue them on the drug. And a lot of the trials do allow this, so we've had some experience doing this, and it can be quite effective that one site or two sites of disease are growing, but other sites are stable, and then treating them locally and continuing on the drug can still provide benefit. I can't say that we have good data to show for sure that that's an effective way to treat someone, but I could say anecdotally, I've done that with several patients and they've done quite well for a long time. So if this patient had growth of one lung lesion, let's say, I would feel very comfortable considering maybe biopsying it to prove that it really is tumor progression, and then considering maybe a radiation and then continuing him on the drug.
And I guess that whole escape strategy certainly has been used a lot in targeted therapy also.
Exactly. Very similar idea. We know less about it than we know with the targeted therapies, just because they haven't been around as long. But yes, I think it's a very similar idea, trying to understand, is this really progression? Is this something else? And if it really is progression, can we continue the systemic therapy that seems to be working?
So you mentioned the idea of using anti-CTLA-4 antibodies with PD-1 or PD-L1. And of course, we saw some exciting data on that in melanoma at ASCO. What do we know about that strategy in lung cancer?
The data is still early for lung cancer with combination strategies. It does look promising. It looks like the response rates are good. And we don't have great long-term data to know that the duration of response is going to be better with single agents. We don't have randomized data. So there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm, and I'm always looking to see if we have a trial available with a combination immune therapy for my patients. But I think it's difficult to know for sure now that it's going to be better for patients than single agent immune therapy in lung cancer. It is a strategy that I would love to pursue more for patients who have progressed on the single agent. You mentioned before, what would I do for this patient if he progressed? If he was progressing at multiple sites and I clearly had to change therapies, I think giving a combination therapy would be really interesting, but it's, of course, on a clinical trial, so it would have to be a trial where that's possible.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Just sort of going back through this case, a couple other issues related to non-immunotherapy. First, he was initially treated with carboplatin, and we know from surveying both investigators and docs in practice that in metastatic squamous cell first line, we see, actually, it's almost a split between carbo with either paclitaxel, NAB, or GEM. How do you sort of think through upfront therapy?
So I think all of those chemotherapy regimens are reasonable. The benefit of paclitaxel is just the timing. It's once every 3 weeks as opposed to weekly, and I think that honestly is really important for patients. Nab-paclitaxel does look like it can have benefit in patients with squamous cell, and so I think that's also a very reasonable option for patients. It's weekly, so they'd have to be committed to that, and so for this patient, he was more interested in having time away from the hospital. But I think nab-paclitaxel would have been very reasonable for him as well. Gemcitabine I often use in later lines when there's not other therapies. It's not approved for that in lung cancer, but it's something that I consider, and I don't necessarily use it as an upfront therapy.
Any advantage knowing that, I guess nowadays when you start out first line in squamous cell, you're already thinking about second line nivolumab. Any advantage to not giving corticosteroids in that first line setting in terms of knowing the patient's likely to go for immunotherapy?
If they're going to be getting immune therapy later on, it will be enough time that the steroids shouldn't really impact that. You know, I do sometimes treat patients with corticosteroids for symptom management, pain, fatigue, those types of things. And that gets to be a bit of more of an issue because sometimes patients are on, you know, a lower dose, more long-term. And that I would not want to have a patient on steroids when I'm starting immune therapy. But I don't find that it's an issue to treat them with steroids during their first-line therapy, knowing they may get immune therapy later on.
How do you think through second-line chemotherapy in squamous cell, which may get bumped to third line in patients like this? You're going to get a checkpoint inhibitor, but what's next in terms of chemotherapy for you?
In a patient like this who's progressing on, let's say progressing on an immune therapy. So I think if you're thinking about standard options, and I would always love to think about about a trial for a patient like that. But if you're thinking about standard options, I think it still would have to be docetaxel. Of course, there's also the ramucirumab data now that looks like there's a benefit to adding it. But I really would reserve that for patients with a good performance status and also a good discussion of the expected benefit, since the benefit is not so overwhelming, I would say, with the ramucirumab adding it to docetaxel. But I would consider it in certain patients.
Any concerns about using anti-angiogenic in squamous cell traditionally because of bevacizumab We haven't thought about it. From what I could see, the ramucirumab didn't seem to be associated with hemoptysis or other problems in squamous cell. Was that your take?
I agree. I think there were theoretical concerns. I was interested to see the data to see what that would show, but I agree. It doesn't look like there's the toxicity concerns like we have with bevacizumab in squamous cell, so I wouldn't worry about it with this patient.
So I want to ask you about your second patient, but as long as we brought up this issue of second-line therapy and ramucirumab, I'm also interested in non-squamous cancers where, again, the same trial showed that there was a benefit of ramucirumab. Maybe I should ask you first, what's your usual first-line therapy in non-squamous cell and then second-line?
So my usual first-line therapy for non-squamous cell, actually for any patient, is trying to find a trial. Because even in first-line, I still consider trials for patients. More and more now, the immune therapies are moving into first-line setting in combination with chemo, compared to chemo. So that is still the first thing I think about for a patient is a trial. But if they're not a trial candidate or they're not interested in a trial, or we don't have one available, my standard first-line for a non-squamous patient is typically carboplatin. And this is probably going to be controversial, but pemetrexed, I still continue to use. And then I consider bevacizumab for patients when they're eligible for that. I think it's also very reasonable to do carboplatin paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab. And Point Break looked at the toxicity and it looked similar. I guess I just find that pemetrexed isn't really well-tolerated drug. It doesn't have the hair loss associated with it, and I find that important. But it is hard to justify, I think, in some cases that the regimens do look similar in terms of efficacy and toxicity on paper. So that's usually what I do for first-line therapy.
How do you approach in the patient who's going to get carbo, PEM, and let's say bevacizumab if they're eligible? How do you approach the question of maintenance?
Yeah, I always will consider a maintenance therapy for patients who have either responded to therapy or had stable disease after usually four cycles of therapy. And if someone's receiving pemetrexed and bevacizumab, I continue both as long as the toxicity is manageable. If they're just receiving pemetrexed, I continue just pemetrexed alone.
And again, what about second-line therapy?
You know, I will say with the question of maintenance, it's not entirely clear that that's the right strategy. There still are trials that are the data is pending to try to understand what the right strategy is, whether it's pemetrexed and bevacizumab or one or the other. In patients who are tolerating it well, I continue both. I'm not convinced that that's the right thing to do, but that's what I've been doing. And I'm sorry, for second-line therapy.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a similar situation as for the squamous patients. The standard would be docetaxel and then with or without ramucirumab. Again, the data look like there is a survival benefit, but it's not, you know, I was going to say it's not significant. It actually is significant statistically, but I'm not sure that that's clinically significant. And it's also taking into account that there is more toxicity with it. So again, it's a discussion with patients if that is something that they would be interested in pursuing for what is a fairly small survival benefit of about 6 weeks or so. But again, I always think about a trial, especially in second-line patients.
So let's talk about your 51-year-old lady. Looks like she actually started out with the carbo-PEM beginning. What happened with her?
So she initially received chemotherapy. She did well, and then she progressed. And actually, before she even received chemotherapy, she was found to have brain metastases and multiple brain metastases and had whole brain radiation.
So she presented with metastatic adenocarcinoma?
That's right. So she had whole brain radiation and then chemotherapy, and then she was referred to me for consideration of a trial, specifically, as many patients do, coming to look for a trial with immunotherapy. So we had a trial that we were screening her for, and she was being worked up, and as part of the screening, it required a brain MRI, and she had what looked like many new small brain metastases. She was asymptomatic. She was feeling well from it, neurologically stable. But because she had these new brain metastases, she wasn't able to go on that trial without local therapy. Most of the trials require local therapy before going on to the trial. And so it would have been very difficult for her. And I think we see this a lot with our patients, that they've received radiation previously. They have multiple new brain metastases, and to receive additional radiation would either lead to more toxicity or a delay in treatment, or really would be difficult because of the number of lesions. So we actually have a trial here at Yale that uses pembrolizumab for patients with brain metastases. We don't know really anything about whether these immune therapies are effective in the brain. It hasn't really been studied that I know of as of now. And so we have a trial specifically looking at this. So she was actually a great candidate for this trial because she was otherwise eligible for immune therapy. She just had new brain metastases and they were asymptomatic. So she started on pembrolizumab on this trial. For that trial, she did have to test, the tumor had to test positive for PD-L1, which it did. And she's done incredibly well on the trial. So she even just after a few weeks, similar to the other patient I was talking about, she had really a nice clinical response after just a few weeks of therapy. Interestingly, she had a lot of muscle metastases, and so she had a lot of pain from that. And so she had really nice response in terms of pain improvement. She was on high doses of narcotics, and she was able to taper off all of narcotics within just a few weeks. And then on her first set of scans, we saw a great response in her body, but also in her brain. So we've seen this in a few patients on this trial, where we've seen responses in both the brain and the body. This is something that's still, this trial is still ongoing. We're still working through whether this is a good strategy in patients with brain metastases. But for her, it really seemed to benefit her. And she's been on for a long time now, and many months, and she's had continued response both in the brain and the body. She developed hypothyroidism on the trial. She came in very fatigued one day. We, of course, checked her thyroid and cortisol levels, and she was hypothyroid. We started her on replacement, and she's done fine on that.
You mentioned she had muscle metastases. Like, which muscles?
She had one of her muscles in her thigh. Yeah, it's unusual. We don't see it often, but she had this terrible metastasis. And actually, that was the site that we biopsied for the PD-L1 testing, because it's such an unusual site, and it was a metastasis.
This was palpable?
Yes.
Wow.
No longer. No longer palpable.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
What's the thinking in terms of the activity of these drugs in the brain? Is the idea that it gets into the brain, that the T cells get into the brain, or the blood-brain barrier is not relevant?
We really don't know. So it's possible the drug gets in. It is an antibody, which makes it less likely that it crosses the blood-brain barrier. But in patients with metastases, it's possible the barrier is not fully intact. But just as you said, it's possible also the T cells are getting in. So with immune therapy, the drug doesn't have to get in. It's not like chemotherapy or even targeted therapy where the drug needs to get in to be effective. If the T cells can be activated in the periphery and then get into the brain, that potentially could work as well. So it does seem like, we've only treated a handful of patients so far, but we presented our data at ASCO. But it does seem that there is activity in some patients. So something is getting in, but it's not clear exactly what.
Let's talk about your next patient, the 54-year-old man. It's interesting. He actually got the combination of Ipi and Nivo.
Yes. So he also progressed on initial treatment on chemotherapy.
So he was metastatic adeno?
Yep. Metastatic adenocarcinoma. He actually had metastases to the adrenal and to bone. Right before the trial, he had radiation to the bone metastasis, so his pain had improved. And then he started on a combination trial with nivolumab and ipilimumab. So he received about 2 months of therapy. And then he came in when it really was a clinically very well guy, good performance status, really minimal symptoms. And he came in with new dyspnea and hypoxia. And just as I was saying earlier, this is something where in a patient not on immune therapy, of course, you want to be cautious and work someone up for infection and pulmonary embolism. But pneumonitis goes to the top of the list of things you want to rule out in this patient. So even in someone with very minimal symptoms or just a little bit more hypoxic than usual, I will always be really cautious and either get imaging then or see them back very soon, because these are things that you just don't want to miss with immune therapy. So we obtained a CT. Actually, we got a PE protocol CT. He did not have a PE. And it looked like he had new ground glass opacities fairly diffusely throughout his lungs. So we were concerned for pneumonitis. We admitted him to the hospital. He had a new oxygen requirement. We had him go for a bronchoscopy, which we sometimes will do for these patients when it's unclear whether it's infection or pneumonitis. It's really important to sort this out if at all possible, because if we're calling this pneumonitis, it's very different treatment than infection, and you don't want to miss that opportunity to give someone steroids. So there was no evidence of infection in the bronchoscopy. As I said before, he had no PE, and there really was nothing else that could explain this, and the scan was pretty consistent with pneumonitis. So we started him on Selumetrol, and he had an improvement in his symptoms in just a day, really, and improvement in his oxygenation as well.
Anything specific histologically with this pneumonitis?
I'm not sure that we know enough to say that for sure. No, I mean, the thing is that it's actually very nonspecific. Even with this patient and others that we've seen, it looks like there's inflammatory cells on bronchoscopy, but you could see that in any situation. So even that's not that helpful. If you don't find organisms, then less likely to be in pneumonia, but even that's not. You sometimes miss a pneumonia on a bronchoscopy as well. And we often have trouble distinguishing one versus the other, and especially patients with lung cancer who already have baseline issues in their lungs, cancer, prior radiation changes, emphysema. So it can be really challenging to sort these out, both radiographically and then also with a biopsy or washing. So as far as we know now, as far as I know, I don't think there's a great way to sort this out. I think it's putting the whole picture together, ruling out other causes as best as possible, and then knowing that it's a possibility with these drugs.
Now, he's only 54 years old. Was he a smoker or is he a smoker?
He was a prior smoker.
He was symptomatic from this pneumonitis. What's his current situation?
The one incredible thing on the scans, which I didn't mention, besides the new ground glass, he actually, was after just 2 months of therapy, had a response. So he had this adrenal metastasis, went from almost 5 centimeters to 1.7 centimeters. So he had a really nice response to the treatment. We started him on steroids, had a great improvement in his symptoms, fortunately. Went home on a steroid taper. As he was tapering down on the steroids, he actually had a flare of his symptoms, which we do sometimes see. So we often will give these patients who are sick initially a very prolonged course of steroids. So he needed to go up on the steroids and then a slower taper down. So he was on steroids for several months, and we held the therapy that whole time. You know, when someone's on steroids for toxicity, we would never re-challenge them at that point. And then there's always the question of, do you give someone back the immune therapy that, especially someone who responded but had this toxicity? I think in this patient, it was clear that, you know, the trial wouldn't have allowed it anyway because of the severe toxicity. But now as these drugs are approved, now we have more flexibility. And the question is, well, what would we do not on a trial? And is it safe? And we really don't know enough, I think, to say that it's safe to re-challenge someone after a severe toxicity like this. More mild pneumonitis, I might consider it. But for him, we've kept him off therapy. And actually, he's had a sustained response. It's been about 6 months, and he's had a sustained response off of therapy for most of that time. We watch him closely because it's possible that he could relapse, of course, and have worsening tumor progression. And then the question will be, do we re-challenge him then? I think probably not because of the pneumonitis, which we know has led to deaths in several cases. But it's a tough call when someone has progressive disease, but then toxicity with the drug.
So I was going to ask you actually before, when you do use a checkpoint inhibitor, in this case you got both, but I guess normally more commonly PD-1 or PD-L1, how long do you use it for? Do you stop patients after a period of time? Have there been patients who stopped in the trials and had continued responses?
It's another one of those questions that just is not yet answered by the trial. So the trials that we have that are either we have data on or ongoing, they actually do different things. So some of the trials treat patients for a year and then stop. And then many of them will allow retreatment at progression. Some trials, it's 2 years and then they stop. And then now many of the trials are continuous until progression or toxicity. So it's really unclear what to do off of a trial, how long to treat patients. We do see patients like the one I was just discussing where if someone stops therapy, they have a sustained response. And in the trials that require stopping treatment after a year or 2 years, several patients have continued to have responses for even years after. But I think it really is still too early to know the right duration of treatment for these patients. With such minimal toxicity for so many patients, I think it's tempting to continue treatment, but then it gets into issues of cost, of course. These are expensive drugs. Do you really continue forever if someone potentially could have a sustained benefit without the drug? And then potential toxicity down the road, and it's time-consuming for patients to come in. So it really is unclear. I haven't had that issue yet because the drugs just got approved, so I've just actually started using them off protocol. Hopefully we will have more data as these trials mature to understand what's happening after treatment is stopped on these trials, and if re-challenging them after they progress at that time, if that's beneficial.
What do we know about anti-PD-L1 antibodies, and how do they compare both in the laboratory as well as in the clinical research to PD-1 antibodies?
We're starting to learn a lot about the anti-PD-L1 antibodies as well. MPDL-3280A, which was, I think, just recently named atezolizumab, is one of the drugs that we now have good data on. Still, the trials are not quite as far along as with the PD-1 drugs, but they do seem to be incredibly promising as well. And I would say the data that we've seen looks very promising, but again, the data is just a bit behind the PD-1 drugs. So from the data we have, and also from my own experience treating patients, I think it's very hard to distinguish one drug from the other. You know, it's always dangerous to compare across trials and look at response rates with one drug versus another, especially when the different trials use different biomarkers. So, you know, several of the trials require PD-L1 positivity, whereas other trials do not require it. So it's really challenging to compare response rates and survival between the different trials because of the different designs and the biomarker requirements. But I would say, as of now, it really is impossible to know if one drug is better than another. They do seem like they're tolerable, whether they're more tolerable. It's possible that the PD-L1 drugs are more tolerable. There's some thought, at least based on the biology of the immune system and the drugs, that the PD-L1 drugs potentially could be more tolerable, actually, and less toxicity. But I don't know that we've seen that yet in actual practice.
What's the difference in the mechanism of action of anti-PD-L1 versus PD-1?
In a lot of ways, it's actually very similar because the main interaction you're trying to prevent is PD-1 and PD-L1 from interacting. So by either binding or inhibiting the ligand or the receptor, you're preventing that interaction. But because, again, the immune system is complicated, there's other interactions that you're preventing or inhibiting with each of the drugs. And that's where the potential differences in benefit and also toxicity come into play, because you're also blocking other receptor ligand binding with the different drugs. But that main interaction of PD-1 and PD-L1 is being blocked similarly, whether you use the PD-1 or PD-L1 drugs.
So let's finish out talking about your 78-year-old lady.
So this was a patient of mine who had a prior smoking history. She smoked 20 pack years, but many years ago. She had quit 40 years ago. She was initially diagnosed with stage 3A non-small cell lung cancer adenocarcinoma based on biopsy of a mediastinal lymph node, and she received concurrent chemo radiation. She did very well. And then about a year after she finished her treatment, she developed back pain. We obtained some imaging, and she was found to have metastatic disease to her spine and then also bilateral lung nodules. So it looked as if this was now metastatic disease. So we sent her tumor for mutation testing now that we needed to think about a treatment for her. And she had a fairly light smoking history, or I should say more distant smoking history. Every center and every clinician does their mutation testing a bit differently, I think. It's still not entirely clear what the right way to do it is, but the way that we do it here currently at Yale is that we test for the common mutations in cancers, in lung cancers first, and then go broader if that's thought to be indicated. So we initially tested her tumor for KRAS, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and RET, and there's several others in our panel as well, and it was negative entirely.
This initial testing you do, how is it done?
So the gene rearrangements are done by FISH. So ALK, ROS, and RET are all done by FISH. And the other mutations are done by targeted gene sequencing, but just in those genes. It's not a broad panel. I think that it includes maybe about 8 genes or so, looking at about 8 genes. So it was negative in her. And so what we decided to do was send a broader panel on her. So we have other panels besides this one that we are able to send, of course, if there's enough tissue available, which is often our rate-limiting step. So we have a gene panel that includes 409 genes and getting next-generation sequencing on that. So I sent off her tissue for that, but that takes some time to come back. So we actually decided to start chemotherapy in the meantime. So we started chemotherapy, and she did really well. She had a nice improvement in her pain and tolerated treatment very well.
What kind of chemotherapy?
We started her on carboplatin and pemetrexed. So she did very well. And then her mutation testing came back with a mutation in PIK3CA. It was a rare mutation. And also other mutations as well in genes that I hadn't even heard of, because again, the 409 gene panel is a large panel of many mutations. And, you know, you get a report like this and you don't, you're like, you know, PIK3CA is an important gene in cancer and mutations can occur. It's not very common in lung cancer, but it's common in other cancers. And so what do you do with this information? So I had this patient doing well on chemotherapy. She now has a mutation. Is it a driver mutation? Is it oncogenic? Is it important? Is there something to block it? So we actually have what we call a precision medicine tumor board at Yale. I think many hospitals are starting to develop these to try to interpret this data, because you get such a large mass of data and it's very challenging to know sometimes what to do with it. So we discussed her, and it was thought that this was a driver mutation and that it probably was oncogenic and important in her cancer. But then the question is, well, what do you do about it? And there are trials looking at inhibitors of this pathway. I don't know that any of them have been particularly effective in lung cancer, and it's just not common in lung cancer either. So, you know, this may be something that we pursue for her in the future, is looking for a trial that blocks this pathway that seems to be important in her cancer. But right now she's doing very well in chemotherapy, and it's been several months, so she's continuing on what she's on. I think it's actually a good lesson that sometimes more information is potentially helpful in the future, but it definitely was not helpful for her. And you know, we got all of this information that really just came down to, well, chemotherapy was actually the right thing for her. That's really helped her at this point.
And that actually is one of the questions we get a lot from general oncologists. It's not uncommon in lung cancer, as well as a lot of other solid tumors, to sort of run out of approved options fairly quickly and have the patient still in good condition once for the therapy. Should they do some kind of next generation sequencing? Foundation One is one assay that's out there a lot of people are using. But then again, the dilemma of then what do you do with the information? A lot of times mutations come back, as in this case, you're not really sure what it means. Any sort of way to quantitate in your own experience in that kind of situation where, as you say, you've already screened out the common things, EGFR, ALK, et cetera, how often it really ends up helping the patient, at least at this point?
I think it's a low number of patients, fairly low, that it helps once you've screened out the common mutations. But that's not to say that I don't think it's the right thing to do, because even if it's a fairly small number of patients, it still can be helpful. You know, there are rare EGFR mutations even that can be sensitive to EGFR inhibitors that aren't picked up by a lot of the assays. And so even just for that, if anything, in a patient who has a light or never smoking history and doesn't have a mutation on the smaller panels or the targeted panels, I think it makes sense to be more broad and see if there can be something if you look deeper into that gene even. And then there are other genes that aren't included in a lot of initial panels like HER2 and BRAF. We do include those on our initial panel, so we get that information early on. I didn't mention it for this patient, but we also had that she was negative for those. But I commonly will see patients who come for a second opinion here who have had only EGFR and ALK, and now I think more and more ROS1 is being tested, and I think that should be a standard thing to test initially. But when I see those patients who've only had those couple of genes tested, I will send them for other testing, like BRAF and HER2, because those are start to add them up. They're rare, but when you start to add them up, they become more likely, and you know, it's a 1% or 2% each for lung cancers, but it gets to be something where if you start looking, you find them. And then to do these larger panels, I think more commonly you find out information that you don't know what to do with, like this patient. But now there's more commonly are trials that are now really just starting looking at these rare mutations and trying to use targeted therapies that may be approved for other indications and trying to match patients' gene abnormalities to targeted therapies. So I would say occasionally you could find a patient that you can use an off-label drug, like BRAF, HER2, finding targeted therapies for them. But potentially you could find a gene mutation or alteration where you can find a trial for that patient. And I think that that may be the more likely situation where you can look for a trial and try to find that. Whether that's effective is something that we don't know, of course, until we do the trials. But that's how I really approach it, is I'm more looking for something where I could find a trial for a patient, because I think that's more likely than anything with these larger mutation panels right now.